write yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to turn back to matters economic today once again. And we may wax a little theoretical here, so get out your pen and pencil here. And you may want to take some notes on some facts and figures that generally are not publicized. And it has to do today with the topic of the shadow banking system. Shadow banks. What are shadow banks and why are they important? What was their role in the last financial crash? What have they been doing ever since? And are they doing the same thing they were doing before, leading to another financial instability event down the road? Of course, these are global institutions, not just in the U.S., although the shadow banking system is strongly focused, has been since the beginning, several decades ago, in Anglo-American countries. In other words, the U.S. and the U.K. have pioneered a lot of the shadow banking system, their markets, their securities, but the shadow banking system has been actually growing. Even more so, even though it was at the center of the crash here in 2007-8-9, it is growing faster and in some cases at the expense of the traditional banking system. Okay, we need to define some terms, obviously, and then explain why we're focusing on this topic here today. What do we mean when we say shadow banks? Well, basically, it's that part of the financial system, institutional financial system, U.S. and global, that is unregulated. Well, they say they've been regulating it since the 2008 crash, but that's not true. Unregulated financial institutions, are they sometimes called these financial intermediaries? Why intermediary? Because the argument is, these institutions sit between individual investors and households and the traditional banking, regulated banking system, you know, traditional banks, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Wells, Bank of America, Citi, U.S. Bank Corp, Big Five U.S. banks, Barclays, right, RBS, and others in the U.K. Okay, so intermediaries in between, and they supposedly perform a function of raising capital from investors in addition to banks having deposits from investors. Okay, so intermediary, in between. Well, that's not true. They're not really intermediaries. They are the primary financial institutions now of the very high net worth individual investors and that subsection called the ultra high net worth individual investors and the super high net worth individual investors. We'll talk about these folks. These are folks with tens of millions of dollars of investable liquid assets. Investable, important adjective here. In other words, that they can move around quickly into new financial markets. You know, difference between an investable asset and a non-investable is, okay, you got a home, that's an asset, but you can't simply move it into other, the value of your net worth in your home, move it into other assets here, moving it into stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth overnight. Well, investable, or sometimes called liquid assets, are what we're really concerned about, because that's what can generate financial flows of massive dimensions on a dime here, immediately, overnight, into new markets, be it real estate somewhere in Hong Kong or foreign exchange in Brazil or someplace like that. So it's investable assets that we're really interested in, and that's what the shadow banks really are focused on, investable assets of the very high net worth and above, ultra super high net worth individuals. The new financial elite, the new global financial elite, have their money in the shadow banking system. They don't put their money in stocks and low yield bonds. No way. And they move their money around. We need to understand this new financial global elite. And who are they? And what are they doing? And what is their role to the shadow banks? And then we have to understand the role of the shadow banks to the traditional banking system, because there are connections, important connections. And that's why when the shadow banks pull in their horns and create a financial instability event, crisis, crash, they drag the regulated banks along with them. And when that dual banking system, regulated shadow, crashes, well, then the rest of the economy is sucked into the vortex, and we have a big contraction. Okay, so what's the relationship of the shadow banks to the regular banks is what we want. Traditional banks, we want to understand, and we want to understand what's the connections between both of the shadow and regulated banks to the central banks, like the Federal Reserve, you know, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, European Central Bank, major central banks. And we want to ask ourselves the important question, have these central banks lost control of the shadow banking system, or did they never have real control over the shadow banking system? You see, the monetary system is set up where the central banks can influence the amount of money in the economy by a number of tools they use to influence the regulated banks, i.e. the JP Morgans and so forth, creation of the money supply. So the Fed is a entity created to bail out the traditional banks if they get in trouble, and to influence the money supply through the traditional banks. But the further reach of these central banks to the shadow banks becomes weaker and weaker. And in some cases, there's very little influence over the shadow banking system. And if you have a shadow banking system growing larger and larger in terms of total assets by the high net worth individuals, then the control or influence over the economy by the central banks like the Fed, it decreases. And that's what's been happening before the crash in 2007-09, and it's been increasing ever since 2008 in the recovery, as we're going to see here when we start talking about some facts and figures. And do these shadow banks behave differently than traditional banks? Okay, I don't mean to create the impression that the two, shadow and traditional, regulated and unregulated, are so different, because they are connected at the hip. They're loaning each other money back and forth. And that's how the traditional banks participate with the shadow banks in huge amounts of investments and assets, traction from the super rich, right? Hinwis, we'll call them Hinwis, high net worth individuals, HNWI, Hinwis. And we have what we call very high net worth. In other words, investors with $1 to $5 million of investable liquid assets, not their real estate, not their home, you know, not their physical property. I'm talking about liquid assets. $1 to $5 million. That's very high net worth. Okay, then we have ultra high net worth, and these are investors, households, individuals, finance capitalists, whatever you want to call them, with up to $30 million in annual, we're talking about, investable assets. And then we have the super hinwees, where we're talking about 100 million and above. These are finance capitalists. This is the gray blur behind the financial system. You know, they talk about the markets as if this were some mystical thing, some entity that was not human. No, the markets are just, the financial markets are just these people, these finance capitalists, the new elite that has grown up around the shadow banking system, which has been expanding ever since the 1960s and 70s. And, of course, got a big booster in Reagan and another big booster in Clinton and Bush, and they are still accelerating in terms of their control of total global investable assets. And they are becoming even more independent and outside the regulated banking system and the reach of the central banks to stabilize the financial system and therefore the economy. Now, this is not just a recent phenomenon, recent meaning the last several decades. No. Shadow banks have always existed. Okay, from the very beginning, you go back 200 years or more, there were different forms of shadow banks. And that's why money and capital are like water flowing downhill. Okay, you cannot regulate it effectively over the long term. You cannot dam it up over the long term. Money, like water flowing downhill, will find a way, money capital will find a way around the dam. And will create new forms of shadow banks that are unregulated. So you can try to regulate them, and the very rich finance capitalists would just create new forms of institutions outside that regulatory umbrella and framework. This is how it's always been here in the history of capitalism. If you look at the financial crash of 1907 and the Great Depressions, three of them in the 19th century, it's been the same thing. The shadow bank speculators have always driven the crash. And then you get a reaction, at least in the 20th century, not in the 19th, where the government tries to regulate them. And, okay, the new institutions get regulated, and the money flows around the regulatory dam, and new institutions are created by the wealthy and their investors. And on we go to the next round of financial instability, which is inherent within the capitalist system. Inherent. It's always tending towards financial instability. That's its very nature. Okay, examples of shadow banks. Like traditional banks, of course, are the J.P. Morgans, the Wells, and so on, U.S. Bank Corp., you know, of which we have today, oh, about 6,800 in the U.S., maybe. We've lost about 10,000 of these banks in the last few decades, regulated banks. Okay, so who are the shadow banks? Well, names like hedge funds, private equity companies, asset management companies, investment banks, private banks, boutique banks, finance companies, insurance companies, pension funds, money market funds, mutual funds, real estate investment trusts, even sovereign wealth funds, brokers, dealers, right? These are all examples. Government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, right? These are all shadow banks, i.e. unregulated, pretty much. Another characteristic of the shadow banks is, apart from the lack of regulation, is their depositors are the hinwees, the super wealthy. The hinwees, they don't take deposits from small fry like you and I. And in fact, you know, if you don't have a certain minimum number of millions, they don't want you. I mean, you can even bring 500,000 and they turn you down. No, not enough, not worth our time and our effort. So it's the deposits of the very wealthy and deposits of each other. You see, they deposit money and borrow money from each other. hedge funds will borrow from pension funds quite frequently in insurance companies and vice versa and so forth. Well, mutual funds and asset management companies, investment banks, they're all borrowing from each other. So it's wealthy depositors, right? Unregulated intermediaries, wealthy depositors. These are all characteristics of the shadow banks. Now, the shadow banks also invest in highly liquid markets. In other words, markets they can get in and get out of. And they often engage in what's called arbitrage. In other words, I'll borrow a little bit of money here and cost me X amount, and I'll then quickly, overnight even, invest it over here, and it'll give me Y returns, and Y returns will be more than X amount. It may be very minimal, maybe in small percentages, but I'll throw a lot of money at it, and I'll do it many times, and, of course, that all adds up to super, super profits. So arbitrage, so-called, is another characteristic of shadow banks, and investing for capital gains, quick capital gains. When you talk about arbitrage, you're talking about the price differentials. In other words, what's the price, the cost of borrowing this money and investing it over here and getting this return over here real quick, overnight. So it's capital gains, short-term investing, relatively short-term. They don't invest in mom-and-pop business, buying a corporate bond from a small business or medium-sized corporation. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, and I'm back. I apologize to the listeners. We've been having some trouble at the station with the lines being dropped. So I was cut off at an important part of the discussion. I apologize to all of you. I hope you didn't drop off, and I hope you're still there. So let's just pick up where we left off, okay? We were talking about the shadow banks. Who were they? All right, examples, hedge funds, private equity companies, asset management companies, investment banks, private banks, boutique banks, finance companies, insurance companies, money market funds, money market mutual funds, real estate investment trusts, pension funds, etc. These are examples of this segment of the global financial industry that we call now shadow banks. And just to recap some of the characteristics and why they are different from traditional banks, J.P. Morgan Trust and so forth, is that they are less regulated, hardly regulated at all, even though they say they've been regulating them or beginning to recently. That's not really true. They take deposits from very, very wealthy individuals, what we call HNWEs, high net worth individuals. This is the new global financial elite. Shadow banks are interested in investing short term for capital gains. That means in liquid markets that generate price volatility. And another characteristic that I didn't get to that we need to point out is shadow banks rely heavily on leverage. In other words, debt. Debt. That's what we mean by leverage. Borrowing from sources in order to invest in these markets. They put some of their money up, but they borrow from other sources as well. And this is where this connection with the traditional banking system comes in. They often borrow from the regulated banking system. Especially now, because the regulated banking system cannot, since the crash, participate as freely as it did in some of these unregulated entities called structured investment vehicles, hedge funds, and so forth. They are prohibited from doing so to some extent. Okay, they're always getting around it some way, like J.P. Morgan did with its London whale crisis of a year or so ago. Okay, so these are the characteristics of financial intermediaries called the shadow banks. Now, they're connected to the the regular banking system, and they are several steps removed from the influence of the central banks as a result. Because they don't take money from the central banks. So the central banks, like the Fed, cannot influence the behavior as it does with regulated banks because shadow banks get their money from the very wealthy. They don't need to borrow from the government. okay? And they aren't required to participate in that relationship. In other words, the monetary policy of governments and central banks is far less effective today than it's ever been before, because the system, the financial system, is fundamentally outgrown the ability of the central banks to regulate it, and it's growing even faster. All right, so another problem of shadow banks is what's called the opacity problem. In other words, since they're not regulated, and since a lot of this trading that they do is private, there's no way of knowing what they're doing. If you don't know what they're doing, you can't regulate them. And they are at the center of a lot of the problems that have occurred with speculation in derivatives, in foreign exchange, in what's called the LIBOR and Euribor markets, and gold markets, and derivative markets of various kinds, and so forth. And if you've noticed, in the last year or so, the U.S. government's been going after the regulated banks for their participation in all this manipulation of these various markets over the last several years, going back to the financial crash. B of A and Citigroup, of course, who were some of the worst traditional bank offenders in this regard, are really being hit by the Securities Exchange Commission and others as they go after them in the final years of the Obama administration. Another characteristic and problem is what's called short-term borrowing for long-term investment. And this is what's typical of shadow banks as well, short-term borrowing. Right? And again, borrowing heavily from traditional banking system, particularly what's called the repurchase agreements market, but we won't talk about that, sometimes called repos. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this idea that money capital is like water flowing downhill in the capitalist system. In other words, you cannot effectively long-term dam it up and control it. It'll find a way, another way around the regulatory dam, and it will create it, meaning the Hinwis, very high net worth individuals and above, they will find a way to create new institutions and new liquid markets where they can speculate and play for greater gain than they can in regulated financial markets and institutions. All right, let's talk about a recent series of feature stories in the Financial Times, the Global Financial Times out of London. Interesting periodical, much better on financial issues than the Wall Street Journal, and of course New York Times is just, you know, for the small folk when it comes to financial developments reporting. Recently, just this past week, the Bank of England chairman, in other words, the equivalent of the Fed, U.S. Fed, Mark Carney, had an interesting feature story. If you want to look at it, June 16th. Last week, June 16th, page 7, Mark Carney's feature editorial on the need to focus a light on shadow banking. Okay, and this was a kickoff in the Financial Times of a series of articles all week long last week on the shadow banking system. Some of the comments by Carney are interesting here, right? Carney immediately recognizes that shadow banking credit is not effectively controlled. Why? Once again, because it is opaque. You don't know what they're doing. Also, it tends to be based on leverage, in other words, debt, borrowing, and this thing called securitization, where you create financial instruments out of other financial instruments, mark up the price and sell them, and create markets for these financial instruments, liquid markets. And this is where the rich, the Hinwis, like to trade buying and selling, liquid market, short-term, capital gains, speculating, right? And, of course, Carney points out that leverage and debt is not only the only problem. Opacity is not the only problem. The problem is these kind of behaviors are connected to the traditional banking system, which, of course, is connected to the rest of the real economy. And that we see, he sees, boom-bust cycles of excess liquidity and excess leverage and debt being generated by the shadow banking system. Excess liquidity, in other words, money and credit, liquidity. Right? And greater and greater liquidity and leverage tends to be the trend over time generated primarily by the shadow banking system, which then flows over to the regular system. Same thing happens, right? And a proliferation of different financial vehicles and instruments, financial instruments over time. So liquidity, leverage, instruments, markets, and debt, short-term, tend to be driven by the growth of the shadow banking system. And as that system grows, so do these other instability factors, right? Also, since 2008, he sees correctly that the shadow banks are growing much faster than the non-shadow banks, the traditional banks. In other words, as the regulators attempt to put some regulations on the traditional banks, because they can, what happens is the money capital flows. Investors take their money out of the traditional banks and put it into shadow banks to avoid regulatory effects, which dampen profitability. Hinwis are very interested in high rates of return. If they can't get double-digit return, they don't participate in those kind of markets. And if the regulated banks are restricted to low kind of investment, in other words, they can't engage in speculative trading and so forth, then the money flows out of that to those institutions that can continue to do that, even if central banks say we want to regulate them, because these are very global markets, financial and liquid markets. It's impossible for the Fed and others to really regulate them. They want to go where they can speculate, right? In other words, speculation, invest in capital gains, price volatile assets and markets, where they can generate a quick capital gain and move on to the next liquid market, right? Nonetheless, Mark Carney, chairman of the Bank of England, the equivalent of Janet Yellen, who's the Fed chairman here in the U.S., has called for more regulation of the shadow banking system in three proposals. One, new standards to limit traditional banks' exposures to the shadow banks. As we know, in 2007-8-9, what happened was the shadow banks precipitated the crash and dragged down the traditional banks that were associated because they had made loans to the shadow banks and tried to act and were able, to, in some ways, to act like shadow banks, begin acting like shadow banks themselves under George W. Bush. So they became quasi-shadow banks, and as that instability, because they all borrowed from each other, spread from one to the other, the whole system came down. So they want, Carney wants to say, what global regulators should do is limit exposures of these traditional banks, because it's the traditional banks that also loan to the real economy and real folks and real businesses. So if they're in trouble, they stop lending. And it brings down the rest of the economy. So you have a chain effect from financial instability in the shadow banking system, bringing down the regulated banking system, bringing down the rest of the economy. Right? So somehow to build fire breaks, as he calls it, Carney calls it, between the shadow banks and traditional banking system. Also, he proposes reforms to reduce runs on the shadow banks. Okay, you think of a run on the bank where, you know, small depositors, like in the early 1930s, run down to the bank, say, we want all our money out of the bank because we think you may be going under too. And because the whole system is based on what's called fractional banking, in other words, these banks only hold a small percentage of the total assets that are deposited with them. They invest all the rest. If everyone runs down and says, give me all my money back, well, then they can't give you all them, everybody all their money back. That's a run on the bank. That's what's called a retail run. Retail investors, you and I, as in the early 1930s. Well, the shadow banks are made up of the Hinwees and each other. So the runs are really what are called wholesale runs on the banks. Other institutions demand from a shadow bank, give us our money back, or the Hinwees, give us our money back, and you can't get out of it. So you have the crash, wholesale runs. Well, Carney is saying they have to come up with something to reduce the runs on the banks. You see, the way they reduced the runs on retail runs on the banks in the 30s was to create the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Between 1929 and 33, 17,000 banks failed in the U.S. Once they had passed the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Law, not one bank failed after 1934. Stopped it. Well, because people believed the government would make whole any of the losses they might have suffered as a retail depositor. That stopped the runs on the banks. Well, we still have wholesale runs through the shadow banking system. So they're exploring ways of preventing these runs on a wholesale banking system, the shadow banking system, right? We started to have a run in 2008 on that sector of the shadow banks called the money market funds, which is really dangerous. Anyway, what does Carney say? Increase the minimum liquid asset reserves of these shadow banks. Institute a way to temporarily suspend withdrawals and raise the margin requirements. Well, it sounds very much like reforms that were put in place in the traditional banking system, which I don't believe will work because of the global nature of the shadow banking system. And also, third suggestion by Carney was a new global monitoring system. They have to come up with some way to see what these shadow banks are doing, and it's particularly in terms of engaging in excess liquidity and leverage risks. Well, that's the article, feature piece by Carney, that was issued here on the 16th, and following that, Financial Times produced a series of analyses of the shadow banking system. Right. We should say something about the shadow banks and the amount of assets they have under control compared to the assets of the traditional, investable assets, traditional banking system. In my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, written in late 2009, I have a table 7.2, which, based on information at that time, which was from the RGE Monitor of May 26, 2009. This is Nouriel Roubini, one of the few guys who kind of knows what's going on with the shadow banking system and financial instability. Economist out of NYU and owner of RGE Monitor, in 2009 estimated that the traditional banking system had about $10 trillion in assets at the time in the U.S. Okay, top five bank holding companies and other banks and saving institutions, 10.5. Estimated that the shadow banking system had about the same amount of assets in various forms, asset-backed commercial paper, variable rate notes, repos, hedge funds, etc. Okay, so they're about the same size in terms of total assets. Well, if you look at what's going on, get your pencil out here. You may want to mark down some of the facts here. If you look at how the shadow banking system has grown globally since 2009, it's really indicative, and probably why Carney and others are getting worried about this growth and the lack of control over this system, which was at the heart of the last crash. Okay, so where do we go for information on this? Well, there's two interesting reports. Well, first of all, Boston Consulting Group annually puts out a report on total growth of assets, investable assets and total assets, net worth, and investable assets of very high net worth individuals. Global financial assets. And we can break down these finance capitalists, that's who they were, into three categories, right? First, you have the super high net worth individuals, Hinwees. There's about 12,000 of them, based on the BCG report. Globally, this is now. And of course, they are the ones with 100 million plus investable assets, annual assets. So about 12,000 globally people only. And then we have the ultra-high net worth individuals, of which there's about 200,000 of them globally. And then just the very high net worth, those with around 5 million investable assets. Okay. So these are the finance capitalists, and the shadow banks are their preferred institutions. That's the connection, you know. And they invest in these liquid markets around the world globally. Together, these individuals, their institutions, and their markets, and their financial instruments, derivatives being preferred, but foreign exchange, securities based on real estate, and so forth. This is what I call collectively the global money parade, because the money sloshes around from one financial liquid market to the other, you know. And this is the key to understanding the instability in the global financial capitalist system today. It's also the key to understanding why globally real asset investment is progressively slowing. Real asset investment would be investment in plant and equipment and so forth that creates jobs. Investment in which people make things, you see. That's been progressively slowing in terms of its growth rate over the last decade or two, ever since the end of the dot-com boom here in the late 90s. This has been the case. Conversely, it's also been the case that financial investments, securities investment, has been growing apace. So we see financial assets, securities investment accelerating, and we see real investment declining in terms of growth rate. I argue that this trend is directly related to the growth of the shadow banks and this financial elite, who now are able to move their money around much more quickly and looking for faster returns in short-term financial speculation. The Boston Consulting Group report, let's look at those a little bit. In 2009, U.S. Hinwees estimated, according to BCG, about $24 trillion investable assets. Okay, last year, end of last year, $46 trillion. Wow, what a recovery, right? What a recovery. Quite impressive here. And if you look globally, global private wealth in 2009, a little bit over, well, close to $120 trillion globally. And in 2012, $135 trillion. And in 2013, last year, $152 trillion. In other words, what we're looking at is almost a doubling of the wealth of the Hinwees in the U.S. and an increase of by a third of the Hinwees globally in terms of their financial assets. Okay? Now, when I say financial assets, I'm excluding here. I'm purposely excluding assets like real estate, you know, the value of your homes and so forth, or your physical plant, or your business, etc. I'm talking about financial assets, net worth. All right. Globally, $152 trillion now. Up from $92 trillion global private wealth. And this is all forms of wealth. Right? From $92 trillion at the bottom of the crash to $152 trillion today. Again, this is all Boston Consulting Group. So a $60 trillion increase in global private wealth. All right? Now, that's all forms of wealth. That means real estate and physical assets and so forth. But the financial assets that we're talking about is something else. It's a subset of that total, but it's growing as a percentage of the total faster than the rest of the global private wealth increase. All this is the Boston Consulting Group. You can look at this there. What do we have in terms of Hinwees and ultra-high net worth individuals? Well, we've got, if the super Hinwees, those 100 million, are about 12,000, the ultra-Hinwees, there's about 200,000 of them globally. Those with over $30 million annual investable assets. Okay. And if you put in just the very high net worth individuals, you get about $40 trillion. $40 trillion in investable assets. Investable. That's a huge amount of money capital. $40 trillion. Far more money capital than can be invested in creating real goods and services. The problem with capitalism today is not enough profits, not enough money. The problem is too much. And it has nowhere to go. So where does it go? The capitalists create these liquid markets in order to invest in them. They like it because there's greater speculative returns, but they have far more liquidity, far more money than they can invest in cars and car production and so forth, right? Because if they invest too much, they're only going to cut their own financial throat, create overproduction in automobiles, and the prices are going to collapse and so forth. So it's not a good investment. It's not as good investment. Now, there are places around the globe where it still is good for them to do that, like in Asia and China and so forth. And that's where they invest in real assets, real asset investment. But in Europe, Japan, and North America, it's kind of saturated. Real asset growth is saturated. That's not to say that there isn't opportunity and there isn't profits from that. Yes, there is. But it's increasingly saturated at a time when they have all this excess liquidity to invest. So what are they going to do with it? Being rich, they never sit on their money. They create these financial markets globally in which to speculate and make even more money. That's what's called financialization. That's the shift. Now, most of the people who are writing about financialization don't understand the shadow banking system and how it's connected to the real economy and don't provide a class analysis where they really look at who are these financial elite, because they're all interconnected, you know. They are the true internationalists. There's about 70,000 ultra-high net worth individuals in the U.S., 70,000, control about, have assets about $10 trillion. In Europe, next largest, is about 58,000, and they have about $7.7 trillion in investable assets. Okay, so together, North America and Europe have about 17 to 18 trillion of what amounts to about $28 trillion total for ultra-high net worth. In other words, I'm talking about the 200,000 globally, 200,000 people globally who are what we call ultra-high net worth individuals who have $30 million a year to invest in liquid assets. All right. Most of them are in North America and Europe, $17 trillion. But Asia has 44,000. In other words, North America 70, Europe 58, Asia 44,000 of these folks who have $30 million more a year to invest, and their total assets are $6.6 trillion. But Asia is the fastest growing area outside of Japan. We're talking about China and the rest of Asia. Latin America has $2.1 trillion, and there's about 14,000 of these ultra-Henries there. And the rest is distributed, the rest of the world, Middle East, Oceania, Africa. You know, we're looking at about another 10,000 people in all those places, with maybe another $2 trillion total. Okay. So these are the finance capitalists behind the shadow banks. And behind this problem of shadow banking, and the problem is too much liquidity. They got too much money to invest in real production, because if they invested it all in real production, they would overproduce excess capacity and they would only end up losing money. So, they invest primarily in these financial markets they've created for themselves. Where did all this liquidity come from, is the question. Well, it has to do with way back when we created the Bretton Woods system over 1944, half a century ago or more. The Bretton Woods system established the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. And since 1944, the U.S. has been pumping out dollars in the U.S. and globally. And dollars have been accumulating globally around the world, the main trading currency, the dollar, right? Fueling U.S. corporations, foreign direct investment outside the U.S., fueling paying for U.S. imports of, in recent decades, of goods from the rest of the world. All this means money is flowing out. FDI flowing out, imports, money flowing out, more money being created, more money flowing out, and of course then we have the U.S. military empire, wars and bases and foreign aid and so forth, even more money flowing out. So we built up this excess liquidity over the decades, and it began appearing as long ago as the 1960s. And in the 1960s, we have the creation of the euro dollar market, and all this excess money, and finally the Europeans say, well, we want to trade these excess dollars in for gold, because we were still on the Bretton Woods quasi-gold standard, where the U.S. had agreed to convert dollars to gold at $35 an ounce. So the Europeans were saying, well, we want some of the your gold, the U.S., and Richard Nixon said, nope, we're going off of that system. So the Bretton Woods system blew up in the 1970s. And ever since then, it's been what's called central bank's coordinated managed float regime, where the currency is between countries, instead of being fixed to $35 an ounce of gold and the dollar, are now fluctuating a relationship to each other, which means central banks got to pump more money in, the U.S. in particular, to stabilize its currency. And everybody's doing that, been doing that for decades now, so even more liquidity gets pumped into the global system. And now we're talking not just about dollars, but we're talking about the pounds and euros. And now we'll be talking soon about yuan, Chinese money. All right. Now, at the same time, in the 1980s, after the blow-up of the Bretton Woods system and the continued, even more aggressive pumping of money into the global economy, excess liquidity, in other words, we have the eliminating of controls on international capital flows, money capital flows, eliminating those controls, another big factor creating financialization and financial instability. You got to bust up the Bretton Woods system first to unleash this whole process. And, of course, American global economic empire starts it all. Then you bust up the Bretton Woods system. That accelerates the money liquidity creation. And then you eliminate global capital flows driven by the U.S. in the 1980s, and the whole world follows. And now you got money that can slosh around the world. And then you have digitization, money capital. So, you know, the technological factor plays a role here. And money now in the form of electronic accounts can flow back and forth instantaneously. Those three enabling developments, i.e. digitization of money capital, elimination of global capital flow controls, and the bust up of the Bretton Woods system, all these things are major enablers of financialization and the spread of liquidity around the globe. Now, as finance capital begins to create its new markets, global liquid markets and financial institutions, shadow banks, and so forth, anew, it creates new financial securities as well. And it begins this process of securitization, creating securities out of securities, and leverage, more debt, and all of these things converge by the late 1990s into a very unstable system of money flowing around the world, destabilizing it, and with money with a proclivity towards speculation. In other words, quick, short-term financial price, financial asset price fluctuations and volatility. And sometimes that volatility gets out of hand, goes too far, and you get one of these crashes. And, of course, you know, the last one we saw in 2008, before that, you know, dot-com bust, and before that, Asian meltdown, Latin America liquidity crises, tequila crisis in Mexico, you know, emerging markets, Japan's bust in the 90s, Northern European banks, et cetera, et cetera. SNLs in the 80s here in the U.S., and these financial instability events have been growing in terms of magnitude and frequency. And why? Because you got all this excess liquidity, and it's focused, concentrated in the shadow banking system, i.e. The preferred institutions, investing institutions of the Hinwis, who are the new financial capitalist elite of the world, driving the economy. These are the fundamental causes behind the crisis. But the crisis, really, in its most fundamental form, represents a change in the magnitude composition of the global capitalist elite, shifting towards finance and a growing proclivity to speculate, and the institutions for regulating capitalism are growing weaker and weaker as a result. Now, there's some interesting debates among economists on all of this. But I take issue with both mainstream economists and Marxist economists because neither of them really understands finance. They don't understand the fact that along with these trends I just mentioned is a trend towards creating what's called inside money or credit. Money is obviously a form of credit. You can lend it and so on and so forth, right? But credit need not be money. Money and credit are not identical, and mainstream economists do not do not understand credit and this growth of inside money, which represents an even further distancing of the money system from the central banks. They cannot create credit or influence credit. Central banks, they can influence money and therefore credit through money, but not non-money forms of credit. We got non-money forms of credit proliferating and growing now, which makes the ability to regulate the system even greater. And that's a consequence of not just technology, but the shadow banking system that creates credit without money, you see. Mainstream economists do not understand this development, the difference between credit and money. They tend to see only money regulating interest rates and real investment. They don't have financial variables in their forecasts and in their models very well accounted for, and therefore they don't understand the role of financial factors and instability on the system. And Marxist economists make a similar mistake. They believe everything has to do with production and the falling rate of profit, and they too don't account for financial variables very well, and don't understand the nature of credit and how it is differentiated today from money. Well, we don't have time to go into both of them in any great detail, but just to recap here what we've been talking about, the shadow banking system is at the heart of the instability, and it's growing bigger, much faster than even the traditional banking system in this recovery period. And now central bankers like Mark Carney and others recognize this and are raising a red flag and say, oh, we got to find some way to regulate this shadow banking system, because it is the true determinant of global financial instability. And if we don't bring these institutions control here, we may have another financial crisis going forward. And they're absolutely true about that assumption, that could and might very well happen. Okay, that's shadow banking. So much more to be said, and maybe in future shows we will say more about it. But remember the shadow banks. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.